investigation. He wrapped his fingers around the medallion and pulled. The chain parted and he lifted the thing, dripping, into the air. He rather expected a Jesus man sigil, what was called the crucifix or the rood, but a small rectangle hung from the chain instead. The object looked like pure gold. Engraved into it was this legend: James, loved of family, loved of God. Roland, who had been almost too revolted to reach into the polluted water, as a younger man he never could have brought himself to that, was now glad he'd done it. He might never run into any of those who had loved this boy, but he knew enough of Ka to think it might be so. In any case, it was the right thing. So was giving the kid a decent burial. Assuming that was he could get the body out of the trough without having it break apart inside the clothes. Roland was considering this, trying to balance what might be his duty in this circumstance against his growing desire to get out of this town, when Topsy finally fell dead. The roan went over with a creak of gear and a last waffling groan as it hit the ground. Roland turned and saw 8 people in the street walking toward him in a line, like beaters who hope to flush out birds or drive small game. Their skin was waxy green. Folk wearing such skin would likely glow in the dark like ghosts. It was hard to tell their sex, and what could it matter, to them or anyone else? They were slow mutants, walking with the hunched deliberation of corpses reanimated by some arcane magic. The dust had muffled their feet like carpet. With the dog banished, they might well have gotten within attacking distance if Topsy hadn't done Roland the favor of dying at such an opportune moment. No guns that Roland could see. They were armed with clubs. These were chair legs and table legs for the most part, but Roland saw one that looked made rather than seized. It had a bristle of rusty nails sticking out of it, and he suspected it had once been the property of a saloon bouncer, possibly the one who kept school in the Bustling Pig. Roland raised his pistol, aiming at the fellow in the center of the line. Now he could hear the shuffle of their feet and the wet snuffle of their breathing, as if they all had bad chest colds. Came out of the mines, most likely, Roland thought. There are radium mines somewhere about. That would account for the skin. I wonder that the sun doesn't kill them. Then, as he watched, the one on the end, a creature with a face like melted candle wax, did die, or collapsed at any rate. Roland was quite sure it was a male, went to his knees with a low, gobbling cry, groping for the hand of the thing walking next to it, something with a lumpy, bald head and red sores sizzling on its neck. This creature took no notice of its fallen companion, but kept its dim eyes on Roland, lurching along in rough step with its remaining companions.
"Stop where you are," Roland said. "Wear me if you'd live to see day's end. Wear me very well."
He spoke mostly to the one in the center who wore ancient red suspenders over rags of shirt and a filthy bowler hat. This gent had only one good eye, and it peered at the gunslinger with a greed as horrible as it was unmistakable. The one beside bowler hat, Roland believed this one might be a woman with the dangling vestiges of breasts beneath the vest it wore, threw the chair leg it held. The arc was true, but the missile fell 10 yards short. Roland thumbed back the trigger of his revolver and fired again. This time the dirt displaced by the slug kicked up on the tattered remains of bowler hat's shoe instead of on a lame dog's paw. The green folk didn't run as the dog had, but they stopped, staring at him with their dull greed. Had the missing folk of Aluria finished up in these creatures' stomachs? Roland couldn't believe it, although he knew perfectly well that such as these held no scruple against cannibalism. And perhaps it wasn't cannibalism, not really. How could such things as these be considered human, whatever they might once have been? They were too slow, too stupid. If they had dared come back into town after the sheriff had run them out, they would have been burned or stoned to death. Without thinking about what he was doing, wanting only to free his other hand to draw his second gun if the apparitions didn't see reason, Roland stuffed the medallion that he had taken from the dead boy into the pocket of his jeans, pushing the broken fine-link chain in after. They stood staring at him, their strangely twisted shadows drawn out behind them. What next? Tell them to go back where they'd come from? Roland didn't know if they'd do it, and in any case had decided he liked them best where he could see them. And at least there was no question now about staying to bury the boy named James. That conundrum had been solved.
"Stand steady," he said in the low speech, beginning to retreat. "First fellow that moves."
Before he could finish, one of them, a thick-chested troll with a pouty toad's mouth and what looked like gills on the sides of his wattled neck, lunged forward, gibbering in a high-pitched and peculiarly flabby voice. It might have been a species of laughter. He was waving what looked like a piano leg. Roland fired. Mr. Toad's chest caved in like a bad piece of roofing. He ran backward several steps, trying to catch his balance and clawing at his chest with the hand not holding the piano leg. His feet, clad in dirty red velvet slippers with curled-up toes, tangled in each other and he fell over, making a queer and somehow lonely gargling sound. He let go of his club, rolled over on one side, tried to rise, and then fell back into the dust. The brutal sun glared into his open eyes, and as Roland watched, white tendrils of steam began to rise from his skin, which was rapidly losing its green undertint. There was also a hissing sound, like a gob of spit on top of a hot stove.
"Saves explaining, at least," Roland thought, and swept his eyes over the others. "All right, he was the first one to move. Who wants to be the second?"
None did, it seemed. They only stood there watching him, not coming at him, but not retreating either. He thought, as he had about the cross dog, that he should kill them as they stood there, just draw his other gun and mow them down. It would be the work of seconds only, and child's play to his gifted hands, even if some ran. But he couldn't. Not just cold like that. He wasn't that kind of killer, at least not yet. Very slowly he began to step backward, first bending his course around the watering trough, then putting it between him and them. When Bowler Hat took a step forward, Roland didn't give the others in the line a chance to copy him. He put a bullet into the dust of the high street an inch in advance of Bowler Hat's foot.
"That's your last warning," he said, still using the low speech.
He had no idea if they understood it, didn't really care. He guessed they caught this tune's music well enough.
"Next bullet I fire eats up someone's heart. The way it works is you stay and I go. You get this one chance. Follow me and you all die. It's too hot to play games and I've lost my..."
"Boo!"
cried a rough, liquidy voice from behind him. There was unmistakable glee in it. Roland saw a shadow grow from the shadow of the overturned freight wagon, which he had now almost reached, and had just time to understand that another of the green folk had been hiding beneath it. As he began to turn, a club crashed down on Roland's shoulder, numbing his right arm all the way to the wrist. He held on to the gun and fired once, but the bullet went into one of the wagon wheels, smashing a wooden spoke and turning the wheel on its hub with a high screeching sound. Behind him he heard the green folk in the street uttering hoarse, yapping cries as they charged forward. The thing which had been hiding beneath the overturned wagon was a monster with two heads growing out of his neck, one with the vestigial slack face of a corpse. The other, although just as green, was more lively. Broad lips spread in a cheerful grin as he raised his club to strike again. Roland drew with his left hand, the one that wasn't numbed and distant. He had time to put one bullet through the bushwhacker's grin, flinging him backward in a spray of blood and teeth, the bludgeon flying out of his relaxing fingers. Then the others were on him, clubbing and drubbing. The gunslinger was able to slip the first couple of blows, and there was one moment when he thought he might be able to spin around to the rear of the overturned wagon, spin and turn and go to work with his guns. Surely he would be able to do that. Surely his quest for the Dark Tower wasn't supposed to end on the sun-blasted street of a little far western town called Eluria, at the hands of half a dozen green-skinned slow mutants. Surely Ka could not be so cruel. But Bowler Hat caught him with a vicious side-hand blow, and Roland crashed into the wagon's slowly spinning rear wheel instead of skirting around it. As he went to his hands and knees, still scrambling and trying to turn, trying to evade the blows which rained down on him, he saw there were now many more than half a dozen. Coming up the street toward the town square were at least 30 green men and women. This wasn't a clan, but a damned tribe of them, and in broad, hot daylight. Slow mutants were, in his experience, creatures that loved the dark, almost like toadstools with brains, and he had never seen any such as these before. The one in the red vest was female. Her bare breast swinging beneath the dirty red vest were the last things he saw clearly as they gathered around and above him, bashing away with their clubs. The one with the nails studded in it came down on his lower right calf, sinking its stupid rusty fangs in deep. He tried again to raise one of the big guns. His vision was fading now, but that wouldn't help them if he got to shooting. He had always been the most hellishly talented of them. Jamie DeCurry had once proclaimed that Roland could shoot blindfolded because he had eyes in his fingers. And it was kicked out of his hand and into the dust. Although he could still feel the smooth sandalwood grip of the other, he thought it was nevertheless already gone. He could smell them, the rich, rotted smell of decaying meat. Or was that only his hands, as he raised them in a feeble and useless effort to protect his head? His hands, which had been in the polluted water where flecks and strips of the dead boy's skin floated? The club slamming down on him, slamming down all over him, as if the green folk wanted not just to beat him to death, but to tenderize him as they did so. And as he went down into the darkness of what he most certainly believed would be his death, he heard the bugs singing, the dog he had spared barking, and the bells hung on the church door ringing. These sounds merged together into strangely sweet music. Then that was gone, too. The darkness ate it all.
2.
Rising, hanging suspended, white beauty, two others, the medallion. The gunslinger's return to the world wasn't like coming back to consciousness after a blow, which he'd done several times before. And it wasn't like waking from sleep, either. It was like rising. I'm dead, he thought at some point during this process, when the power to think had been at least partially restored to him. Dead and rising into whatever afterlife there is. That's what it must be. The singing I hear is the singing of dead souls. Total blackness gave way to the dark gray of rain clouds, then to the lighter gray of fog. This brightened to the uniform clarity of a heavy mist moments before the sun breaks through. And through it all was that sense of rising, as if he had been caught in some mild but powerful updraft. As the sense of rising began to diminish, and the brightness behind his eyelids grew, Roland at last began to believe he was still alive. It was the singing that convinced him. Not dead souls, not the heavenly host of angels sometimes described by the Jesus Man preachers, but only those bugs. A little like crickets, but sweeter voiced. The ones he had heard in Eluria. On this thought, he opened his eyes. His belief that he was still alive was severely tried, for Roland found himself hanging suspended in a world of white beauty. His first bewildered thought was that he was in the sky, floating within a fair-weather cloud. All around him was the reedy singing of the bugs. Now he could hear the tinkling of bells, too. He tried to turn his head and swayed in some sort of harness. He could hear it creaking. The soft singing of the bugs, like crickets in the grass at the end of day back home in Gilead, hesitated and broke rhythm. When it did, what felt like a tree of pain grew up Roland's back. He had no idea what its burning branches might be, but the trunk was surely his spine. A far deadlier pain sank into one of his lower legs. In his confusion, the gunslinger could not tell which one. "That's where the club with the nails in it got me," he thought. And more pain in his head. His skull felt like a badly cracked egg. He cried out and could hardly believe that the harsh crow's call he heard came from his own throat. He thought he could also hear very faintly the barking of the cross dog. But surely that was his imagination. "Am I dying? Have I awakened once more at the very end?" A hand stroked his brow. He could feel it, but not see it, fingers trailing across his skin, pausing here and there to massage a knot or a line. Delicious, like a drink of cool water on a hot day. He began to close his eyes, and then a horrible idea came to him. Suppose that hand were green, its owner wearing a tattered red vest over her hanging dugs.
"What if it is? What could you do?"
"Hush, man," a young woman's voice said. Or perhaps it was the voice of a girl. Certainly the first person Roland thought of was Susan, the girl from Mages, she who had spoken to him as thee.
Where...
"Hush, stir not. 'Tis far too soon." The pain in his back was subsiding now, but the image of the pain as a tree remained, for his very skin seemed to be moving like leaves in a light breeze. How could that be? He let the question go, let all questions go, and concentrated on the small, cool hand stroking his brow. "Hush, pretty man. God's love be upon ye. Yet it's sore hurt ye are. Be still, heal." The dog had hushed its barking, if it had ever been there in the first place, and Roland became aware of that low creaking sound again. It reminded him of horse tethers or something, hang ropes, he didn't like to think of. Now he believed he could feel pressure beneath his thighs, his buttocks, and perhaps, yes, his shoulders.
"I'm not in a bed at all. I think I'm above a bed. Can that be?"
He supposed he could be in a sling. He seemed to remember once as a boy that some fellow had been suspended that way in the horse doctor's room behind the great hall, a stable hand who had been burned too badly by kerosene to be laid in a bed. The man had died, but not soon enough. For 2 nights his shrieks had filled the sweet summer air of the gathering fields.
"Am I burned, then? Nothing but a cinder with legs hanging in a sling?"
The fingers touched the center of his brow, rubbing away the frown forming there. And it was as if the voice which went with the hand had read his thoughts, picking them up with the tips of her clever, soothing fingers.
"Ye'll be fine if God wills, Si,"
the voice which went with the hand said.
"But time belongs to God, not to you."
"No," he would have said, if he had been able. "Time belongs to the tower." Then he slipped down again, descending as smoothly as he had risen, going away from the hand and the dreamlike sounds of the singing insects and chiming bells. There was an interval that might have been sleep, or perhaps unconsciousness, but he never went all the way back down. At one point he thought he heard the girl's voice, although he couldn't be sure because this time it was raised in fury, or fear, or both.
"No," she cried. "Ye can't have it off him, and ye know it. Go your course and stop talking of it, do."
When he rose back to consciousness the second time, he was no stronger in body, but a little more himself in mind. What he saw when he opened his eyes wasn't the inside of a cloud, but at first that same phrase, white beauty, recurred to him. It was in some ways the most beautiful place Roland had ever been in his life, partially because he still had a life, of course, but mostly because it was so fey and peaceful. It was a huge room, high and long. When Roland at last turned his head, cautiously, so cautiously, to take its measure as well as he could, he thought it must run at least 200 yards from end to end. It was built narrow, but its height gave the place a feeling of tremendous airiness. There were no walls or ceilings such as those he was familiar with, although it was a little like being in a vast tent. Above him the sun struck and diffused its light across billowy panels of thin white silk, turning them into the bright swags that he had first mistaken for clouds. Beneath this silk canopy the room was as gray as twilight. The walls, also silk, rippled like sails in a faint breeze. Hanging from each wall panel was a curved rope bearing small bells. These lay against the fabric and rang in low and charming unison, like wind chimes when the walls rippled. An aisle ran down the center of the long room. On either side of it were scores of beds, each made up with clean white sheets and headed with crisp white pillows. There were perhaps 40 on the far side of the aisle, all empty, and another 40 on Roland's side. There were 2 other occupied beds here, one next to Roland on his right. This fellow. It's the boy, the one who was in the trough. The idea ran goosebumps up Roland's arms and gave him a nasty, superstitious start. He peered more closely at the sleeping boy. Can't be. You're just dazed, that's all. It can't be. Yet closer scrutiny refused to dispel the idea. It certainly seemed to be the boy from the trough, probably ill, why else would he be in a place like this? But far from dead. Roland could see the slow rise and fall of his chest, and the occasional twitch of the fingers that dangled over the side of the bed. You didn't get a good enough look at him to be sure of anything. And after a few days in that trough, his own mother couldn't have said for sure who it was. But Roland, who'd had a mother, knew better than that. He also knew that he'd seen the gold medallion around the boy's neck. Just before the attack of the green folk, he had taken it from this lad's corpse and put it in his pocket. Now someone, the proprietors of this place most likely, those who had sorcerously restored the lad named James to his interrupted life, had taken it back from Roland and put it around the boy's neck again. Had the girl with the wonderfully cool hand done that? Did she in consequence think Roland a ghoul who would steal from the dead? He didn't think so. In fact, the notion made him more uncomfortable than the idea that the young cowboy's bloated body had been somehow returned to its normal size and then reanimated. Farther down the aisle on this side, perhaps a dozen empty beds away from the boy and Roland S. Chain, the gunslinger saw a third inmate of this queer infirmary. This fellow looked at least 4 times the age of the lad, 2x the age of the gunslinger. He had a long beard, more gray than black, that hung to his upper chest in 2 straggly forks. The face above it was sun-darkened, heavily lined, and pouched beneath the eyes. Running from his left cheek and across the bridge of his nose was a thick, dark mark which Roland took to be a scar. The bearded man was either asleep or unconscious. Roland could hear him snoring, and was suspended 3 feet above his bed, held up by a complex series of white belts that glimmered in the dim air. These crisscrossed each other, making a series of figure eights all the way around the man's body. He looked like a bug in some exotic spider's web. He wore a gauzy white beddress. One of the belts ran beneath his buttocks, elevating his crotch in a way that seemed to offer the bulge of his privates to the gray and dreaming air. Farther down his body, Roland could see the dark shadow shapes of his legs. They appeared to be twisted like ancient dead trees. Roland didn't like to think in how many places they must have been broken to look like that. And yet, they appeared to be moving. How could they be if the bearded man was unconscious? It was a trick of the light, perhaps. Or of the shadows. Perhaps the gauzy singlet the man was wearing was stirring in a light breeze, or... Roland looked away, up at the billowy silk panels high above, trying to control the accelerating beat of his heart. What he saw hadn't been caused by the wind or a shadow or anything else. The man's legs were somehow moving without moving, as Roland had seemed to feel his own back moving without moving. He didn't know what could cause such a phenomenon, and didn't want to know, at least not yet. "I'm not ready," he whispered. His lips felt very dry. He closed his eyes again, wanting to sleep, wanting not to think about what the bearded man's twisted legs might indicate about his own condition. But
you'd better get ready.
That was the voice that always seemed to come when he tried to slack off, to scamp a job or take the easy way around an obstacle. It was the voice of Cort, his old teacher, the man whose stick they had all feared as boys. They hadn't feared his stick as much as his mouth, however. His jeers when they were weak, his contempt when they complained or tried whining about their lot.
"Are you a gunslinger, Roland? If you are, you better get ready."
Roland opened his eyes again and turned his head to the left again. As he did, he felt something shift against his chest. Moving very slowly, he raised his right hand out of the sling that held it. The pain in his back stirred and muttered. He stopped moving until he decided the pain was going to get no worse, if he was careful at least, then lifted the hand the rest of the way to his chest. It encountered finely woven cloth, cotton. He moved his chin to his breastbone and saw that he was wearing a beddress like the one draped on the body of the bearded man. Roland reached beneath the neck of the gown and felt a fine chain. A little farther down, his fingers encountered a rectangular metal shape. He thought he knew what it was, but had to be sure. He pulled it out, still moving with great care, trying not to engage any of the muscles in his back. A gold medallion. He dared the pain, lifting it until he could read what was engraved upon it. James. Loved of family. Loved of God. He tucked it into the top of the beddress again and looked back at the sleeping boy in the next bed. In it, not suspended over it. The sheet was only pulled up to the boy's rib cage, and the medallion lay on the pristine white breast of his beddress. The same medallion Roland now wore, except... Roland thought he understood, and understanding was a relief. He looked back at the bearded man and saw an exceedingly strange thing. The thick black line of scar across the bearded man's cheek and nose was gone. Where it had been was the pinkish-red mark of a healing wound, a cut, or perhaps a slash.
I imagined it.
"No, gunslinger," Cort's voice returned. "Such as you was not made to imagine, as well you know."
The little bit of movement had tired him out again, or perhaps it was the thinking which had really tired him out. The singing bugs and chiming bells combined had made something too much like a lullaby to resist. This time, when Roland closed his eyes, he slept. 3. 5 sisters, Jenna, the doctors of Illuria, the medallion, a promise of silence. When Roland awoke again, he was at first sure that he was still sleeping, dreaming, having a nightmare. Once, at the time he had met and fallen in love with Susan Delgado, he had known a witch named Rhea, the first real witch of Midworld he had ever met. It was she who had caused Susan's death, although Roland had played his own part. Now, opening his eyes and seeing Rhea not just once but five times over, he thought, "This is what comes of remembering those old times. By conjuring Susan, I've conjured Rhea of the Coos as well. Rhea and her sisters." The five were dressed in billowing habits as white as the walls and the panels of the ceiling. Their antique crones' faces were framed in wimples just as white, their skin as gray and runneled as droughted earth by comparison. Hanging like phylacteries from the bands of silk imprisoning their hair, if indeed they had hair, were lines of tiny bells which chimed as they moved or spoke. Upon the snowy breast of their habits was embroidered a blood-red rose, the sigil of the Dark Tower. Seeing this, Roland thought, "I'm not dreaming. These Harridans are real."
"He wakes!"
one of them cried in a gruesomely coquettish voice.
"Ooh! Ooh! Ah!"
They fluttered like birds. The one in the center stepped forward, and as she did, their faces seemed to shimmer like the silk walls of the ward. They weren't old after all, he saw, middle-aged, perhaps, but not old. Yes, they are old. They changed. The one who now took charge was taller than the others, and with a broad, slightly bulging brow. She bent toward Roland, and the bells that fringed her forehead tinkled. The sound made him feel sick somehow, and weaker than he had felt a moment before. Her hazel eyes were intent, greedy, mayhap. She touched his cheek for a moment, and a numbness seemed to spread there. Then she glanced down, and a look which could have been disquiet cramped her face. She took her hand back.
"Ye wake, pretty man, so ye do. 'Tis well."
"Who are you? Where am I?"
"We are the Little Sisters of Eluria," she said. "I am Sister Mary. Here is Sister Louise, and Sister Michella, and Sister Coquina." "And Sister Tamra," said the last. "A lovely lass of 21.
She giggled. Her face shimmered, and for a moment she was again as old as the world. Hooked of nose, gray of skin. Roland thought once more of Rhea. They moved closer, encircling the complication of harness in which he lay suspended, and when Roland shrank back, the pain roared up his back and injured leg again. He groaned. The straps holding him creaked.
"Ooh, it hurts. Hurts him. Hurts so fierce."
They pressed even closer, as if his pain fascinated them. And now he could smell them, a dry and earthy smell. The one named Sister Michella reached out.
"Go away, leave him. Have I not told ye before?"
They jumped back from this voice, startled. Sister Mary looked particularly annoyed, but she stepped back with one final glare, Roland would have sworn it, at the medallion lying on his chest. He had tucked it back under the bed-dress at his last waking, but it was out again now. A sixth sister appeared, pushing rudely in between Mary and Tamra. This one, perhaps, was only 21, with flushed cheeks, smooth skin, and dark eyes. Her white habit billowed like a dream. The red rose over her breast stood out like a curse.
"Go, leave him!"
"Ooh, my dear,"
cried Sister Louise in a voice both laughing and angry.
"Here's Jenna, the baby, and has she fallen in love with him?" "She has,"
said Tamra, laughing.
"Baby's heart is his for the purchase." "Oh, so it is,"
agreed Sister Coquina. Mary turned to the newcomer, lips pursed into a tight line.
"Ye have no business here, saucy girl."
"I do if I say I do,"
Sister Jenna replied. She seemed more in charge of herself now. A curl of black hair had escaped her wimple and lay across her forehead in a comma.
Now go. He's not up to your jokes and laughter.
Order us not, Sister Mary said, for we never joke, so you know, Sister Jenna.
The girl's face softened a little, and Roland saw she was afraid. It made him afraid for her, for himself as well.
Go, she repeated. 'Tis not the time. Are there not others to tend?
Sister Mary seemed to consider. The others watched her. At last she nodded and smiled down at Roland. Again her face seemed to shimmer, like something seen through a heat haze. What he saw, or thought he saw, beneath, was horrible and watchful.
"Bide well, pretty man," she said to Roland. "Bide with us a bit, and we'll heal ye."
"What choice have I?" Roland thought.
The others laughed, bird-like titters which rose into the dimness like ribbons. Sister Michella actually blew him a kiss.
"Come, ladies," Sister Mary cried. "We'll leave Jenna with him a bit in memory of her mother, whom we loved well."
And with that she led the others away, five white birds flying off down the center aisle, their skirts nodding this way and that. "Thank you," Roland said, looking up at the owner of the cool hand, for he knew it was she who had soothed him. She took up his fingers as if to prove this, and caressed them.
"They mean ye no harm," she said.
Yet Roland saw she believed not a word of it, nor did he. He was in trouble here, very bad trouble.
"What is this place?"
"Our place," she said simply. "The home of the Little Sisters of Eluria. Our convent, if you like."
"This is no convent," Roland said, looking past her at the empty beds. "It's an infirmary, isn't it?"
"A hospital," she said, still stroking his fingers. "We serve the doctors, and they serve us."
He was fascinated by the black curl lying on the cream of her brow, would have stroked it if he had dared reach up, just to tell its texture. He found it beautiful because it was the only dark thing in all this white. The white had lost its charm for him.
"We are hospitalers, or were before the world moved on."
"Are you for the Jesus man?"
She looked surprised for a moment, almost shocked, and then laughed merrily.
"No, not us."
"If you are hospitalers, nurses, where are the doctors?"
She looked at him, biting her lip as if trying to decide something. Roland found her doubt utterly charming, and he realized that, sick or not, he was looking at a woman as a woman for the first time since Susan Delgado had died, and that had been long ago. The whole world had changed since then, and not for the better.
"Would you really know?"
"Yes, of course," he said, a little surprised. A little disquieted, too.
He kept waiting for her face to shimmer and change, as the faces of the others had done. It didn't. There was none of that unpleasant dead earth smell about her either.
"Wait," he cautioned himself. "Believe nothing here, least of all your senses. Not yet."
"I suppose you must," she said with a sigh.
It tinkled the bells at her forehead, which were darker in color than those the others wore. Not black like her hair, but charry somehow, as if they had been hung in the smoke of a campfire. Their sound, however, was brightest silver.
"Promise me you'll not scream and wake the pube in yonder bed."
"Pube?"
"The boy. Do ye promise?"
"Aye," he said,
falling into the half-forgotten patois of the outer arc without even being aware of it, Susan's dialect.
"It's been long since I screamed, pretty."
She colored more definitely at that. Roses, more natural and lively than the one on her breast, mounting in her cheeks.
"Don't call pretty what ye can't properly see," she said.
"Then push back the wimple you wear."
Her face he could see perfectly well, but he badly wanted to see her hair, hungered for it almost. A full flood of black in all this dreaming white, Of course it might be cropped. Those of her order might wear it that way, but he somehow didn't think so.
No, 'tis not allowed.
By whom?
Big sister.
She who calls herself Mary?
Aye, her.
She started away, then paused and looked back over her shoulder. In another girl her age, one as pretty as this, that look back would have been flirtatious. This girl's was only grave.
Remember your promise.
Aye, no screams.
She went to the bearded man, skirt swinging. In the dimness she cast only a blur of shadow on the empty beds she passed. When she reached the man, this one was unconscious, Roland thought, not just sleeping, she looked back at Roland once more. He nodded. Sister Jenna stepped close to the suspended man on the far side of his bed so that Roland saw her through the twists and loops of woven white silk. She placed her hands lightly on the left side of his chest, bent over him, and shook her head from side to side, like one expressing a brisk negative. The bells she wore on her forehead rang sharply, and Roland once more felt that weird stirring up his back, accompanied by a low ripple of pain. It was as if he had shuddered without actually shuddering, or shuddered in a dream. What happened next almost did jerk a scream from him. He had to bite his lips against it. Once more the unconscious man's legs seemed to move without moving, because it was what was on them that moved. The man's hairy shins, ankles, and feet were exposed below the hem of his beddress. Now a black wave of bugs moved down them. They were singing fiercely, like an army column that sings as it marches. Roland remembered the black scar across the man's cheek and nose, the scar that had disappeared. More such as these, of course. And they were on him as well. That was how he could shiver without shivering. They were all over his back, battening on him. No, keeping back a scream wasn't as easy as he had expected it to be. The bugs ran down to the tips of the suspended man's toes, then leapt off them in waves, like creatures springing off an embankment and into a swimming hole. They organized themselves quickly and easily on the bright white sheet below, and began to march down to the floor in a battalion about a foot wide. Roland couldn't get a good look at them. The distance was too far and the light too dim, but he thought they were perhaps twice the size of ants, and a little smaller than the fat honeybees which had swarmed the flower beds back home. They sang as they went. The bearded man didn't sing. As the swarms of bugs that had coated his twisted legs began to diminish, he shuddered and groaned. The young woman put her hand on his brow and soothed him, making Roland a little jealous even in his revulsion at what he was seeing. And was what he was seeing really so awful? In Gilead, leeches had been used for certain ailments, swellings of the brain, the armpits, and the groin primarily. When it came to the brain, the leeches, ugly as they were certainly preferable to the next step, which was trepanning. Yet there was something loathsome about them, perhaps only because he couldn't see them well, and something awful about trying to imagine them all over his back as he hung here, helpless. Not singing, though. Why? Because they were feeding? Sleeping? Both at once? The bearded man's groans subsided. The bugs marched away across the floor toward one of the mildly rippling silken walls. Roland lost sight of them in the shadows. Jenna came back to him, her eyes anxious.
Ye did well, yet I see how ye feel. It's on your face.
The doctors, he said.
Yes, their power is very great, but,
she dropped her voice,
I believe that drover is beyond their help. His legs are a little better, and the wounds on his face are all but healed. But he has injuries where the doctors cannot reach.
She traced a hand across her midsection, suggesting the location of these injuries, if not their nature. "And me?" Roland asked.
"Ye were ta'en by the green folk," she said. "Ye must have angered them powerfully for them not to kill ye outright. They roped ye and dragged ye instead. Tamra, Michelle, and Louise were out gathering herbs. They saw the green folk at play with ye and bade them stop, but—"
"Do the muties always obey you, Sister Jenna?" She smiled, perhaps pleased he remembered her name.
"Not always, but mostly. This time they did, or ye'd have now found the clearing in the trees."
"I suppose so."
"The skin was stripped almost clean off your back. Red ye were from nape to waist. Ye'll always bear the scars, but the doctors have gone far toward healing ye. And their singing is passing fair, is it not?"
"Yes," Roland said. But the thought of those black things all over his back, roosting in his raw flesh, still revolted him. "I owe you thanks and give it freely. Anything I can do for you."
"Tell me your name, then. Do that."
"I'm Roland of Gilead, a gunslinger. I had revolvers, Sister Jenna. Have you seen them?"
"I've seen no shooters," she said, but cast her eyes aside.
The roses bloomed in her cheeks again. She might be a good nurse and fair, but Roland thought her a poor liar. He was glad. Good liars were common. Honesty, on the other hand, came dear. "Let the untruth pass for now," he told himself. "She speaks it out of fear, I think."
"Jenna?"
The cry came from the deeper shadows at the far end of the infirmary. Today it seemed longer than ever to the gunslinger. And Sister Jenna jumped guiltily.
"Come away. Ye've passed words enough to entertain 20 men. Let him sleep."
"Aye," she called, then turned back to Roland. "Don't let on that I showed you the doctors."
"Mum is the word, Jenna." She paused, biting her lip again, then suddenly swept back her wimple. It fell against the nape of her neck in a soft chiming of bells. Freed from its confinement, her hair swept against her cheeks like shadows.
"Am I pretty? Am I? Tell me the truth, Roland of Gilead, no flattery. For flattery's kind only a candle's length."
"Pretty as a summer night." What she saw in his face seemed to please her more than his words, because she smiled radiantly. She pulled the wimple up again, tucking her hair back in with quick little finger pokes.
"Am I decent?"
"Decent as fair," he said, then cautiously lifted an arm and pointed at her brow. "One curl's out, just there."
"Aye, always that one to devil me."
With a comical little grimace, she tucked it back. Roland thought how much he would like to kiss her rosy cheeks, and perhaps her rosy mouth for good measure. "All's well," he said.
"Jenna!"
The cry was more impatient than ever.
"Meditations!"
"I'm coming just now,"
she called, and gathered her voluminous skirts to go. Yet she turned back once more, her face now very grave and very serious.
"One more thing," she said in a voice only a step above a whisper. She snatched a quick look around. "The gold medallion ye wear it because it's yours. Do we understand, James?"
"Yes." He turned his head a bit to look at the sleeping boy. "This is my brother."
"If they ask, yes. To say different would be to get Jenna in serious trouble."
How serious, he did not ask. And she was gone, in any case, seeming to flow along the aisle between all the empty beds, her skirt caught up in one hand. The roses had fled from her face, leaving her cheeks and brow ashy. He remembered the greedy look on the faces of the others, how they had gathered around him in a tightening knot, and the way their faces had shimmered. 6 women, 5 old and 1 young. Doctors that sang and then crawled away across the floor when dismissed by jingling bells, and an improbable hospital ward of perhaps 100 beds, a ward with a silk roof and silk walls, and all the beds empty save 3. Roland didn't understand why Jenna had taken the dead boy's medallion from his pants pocket and put it around his neck, but he had an idea that if they found out she had done so, the little sisters of Aluria might kill her. Roland closed his eyes, and the soft singing of the doctor insects once again floated him off into sleep. 4. A bowl of soup, the boy in the next bed, the night nurses. Roland dreamed that a very large bug, a doctor bug mayhap, was flying around his head and banging repeatedly into his nose, collisions which were annoying rather than painful. He swiped at the bug repeatedly, and although his hands were eerily fast under ordinary circumstances, he kept missing it, and each time he missed, the bug giggled.
"I'm slow because I've been sick," he thought.
No, ambushed, dragged across the ground by slow mutants, saved by the little sisters of Aluria. Roland had a sudden vivid image of a man's shadow growing from the shadow of an overturned freight wagon, heard a rough, gleeful voice cry, "Boo!" He jerked awake hard enough to set his body rocking in its complication of slings, and the woman who had been standing beside his head, giggling as she tapped his nose lightly with a wooden spoon, stepped back so quickly that the bowl in her other hand slipped from her fingers. Roland's hands shot out, and they were quick as ever. His frustrated failure to catch the bug had been only part of his dream. He caught the bowl before more than a few drops could spill. The woman, Sister Coquina, looked at him with round eyes. There was pain all up and down his back from the sudden movement, but it was nowhere near as sharp as it had been before, and there was no sensation of movement on his skin. Perhaps the doctors were only sleeping, but he had an idea they were gone. He held out his hand for the spoon Coquina had been teasing him with. He found he wasn't surprised at all that one of these would tease a sick and sleeping man in such a way. It would have surprised him only if it had been Jenna. And she handed it to him, her eyes still big.
"How speedy ye are," she said. "'Twas like a magic trick, and you still rising from sleep."
"Remember it, Si," he said, and tried the soup. There were tiny bits of chicken floating in it. He probably would have considered it bland under other circumstances, but under these it seemed ambrosial. He began to eat greedily.
"What do we mean by that?" she asked.
The light was very dim now, the wall panels across the way a pinkish orange that suggested sunset. In this light, Coquina looked quite young and pretty. But it was a glamour, Roland was sure. A sorceress kind of makeup.
"I mean nothing in particular."
Roland dismissed the spoon as too slow, preferring to tilt the bowl itself to his lips. In this way he disposed of the soup in 4 large gulps.
"You've been kind to me."
"Aye, so we have,"
she said rather indignantly.
"And I hope your kindness has no hidden motive. If it does, sister, remember that I'm quick. And as for myself, I have not always been kind."
She made no reply, only took the bowl when Roland handed it back. She did this delicately, perhaps not wanting to touch his fingers. Her eyes dropped to where the medallion lay, once more hidden beneath the breast of his bed-dress. He said no more, not wanting to weaken the implied threat by reminding her that the man who made it was unarmed, next to naked, and hung in the air because his back couldn't yet bear the weight of his body.
"Where's Sister Jenna?" he asked.
"Ooh,"
Sister Coquina said, raising her eyebrows.
"We like her, do we? She makes our heart go."
She put her hand against the rose on her breast and fluttered it rapidly.
"Not at all, not at all," Roland said.
but she was kind. I doubt she would have teased me with a spoon, as some would. Sister Coquina's smile faded. She looked both angry and worried.
Say nothing of that to Mary if she comes by later. You might get me in trouble.
Should I care?
I might get back at one who caused me trouble by causing little Jenna trouble,
Sister Coquina said.
She's in Big Sister's black books just now, anyway. Sister Mary doesn't care for the way Jenna spoke to her about ye, nor does she like it that Jenna came back to us wearing the dark bells.
This was scarcely out of her mouth before Sister Coquina put her hand over that frequently imprudent organ, as if realizing she had said too much. Roland, intrigued by what she'd said, but not liking to show it just now, only replied,
I'll keep my mouth shut about you if you keep your mouth shut to Sister Mary about Jenna.
Coquina looked relieved.
Aye, that's a bargain.
She leaned forward confidingly.
She's in Thoughtful House. That's the little cave in the hillside where we have to go and meditate when Big Sister decides we've been bad. She'll have to stay and consider her impudence until Mary lets her out.
She paused, then said abruptly,
Who's this beside ye, do ye know?
Roland turned his head and saw that the young man was awake and had been listening. His eyes were as dark as Jenna's.
"Know him?" Roland asked, with what he hoped was the right touch of scorn. "Should I not know my own brother?"
"Is he now, and him so young, and you so old?"
Another of the sisters materialized out of the darkness, Sister Tamra, who had called herself 21. In the moment before she reached Roland's bed, her face was that of a hag who will never see 80 again, or 90. Then it shimmered and was once more the plump, healthy countenance of a 30-year-old matron. Except for the eyes. They remained yellowish in the corneas, gummy in the corners, and watchful.
He's the youngest, I the eldest, Roland said. Betwixt us are 7 others, and 20 years of our parents' lives.
How sweet! And if he's your brother, then ye'll know his name, won't ye? Know it very well.
Before the gunslinger could flounder, the young man said,
They think you've forgotten such a simple hook as John Norman. What colleens they be, eh, Jimmy?
Coquina and Tamra looked at the pale boy in the bed next to Roland's, clearly angry and clearly trumped, for the time being, at least.
You fed him your muck, said the boy, whose medallion undoubtedly proclaimed him John, loved of family, loved of God. Why don't you go and let us have a natter?
Well,
Sister Coquina huffed,
I like the gratitude around here, so I do.
I'm grateful for what's given me, Norman responded, looking at her steadily, but not for what folk would take away.
Tamra snorted through her nose, turned violently enough for her swirling dress to push a draft of air into Roland's face, and then took her leave. Coquina stayed a moment.
Be discreet, and mayhap someone ye like better than ye like me will get out of hack in the morning instead of a week from tonight.
Without waiting for a reply, she turned and followed Sister Tamra. Roland and John Norman waited until they were both gone, and then Norman turned to Roland and spoke in a low voice.
My brother, dead?
Roland nodded.
The medallion I took in case I should meet with any of his people. It rightly belongs to you. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you, Si.
John Norman's lower lip trembled, then firmed.
I knew the green men did for him, although these old biddies wouldn't tell me for sure. They did for plenty and scotched the rest.
Perhaps the sisters didn't know for sure.
They knew, don't you doubt it.
They don't say much, but they know plenty. The only one any different is Jenna. That's who the old battle axe meant when she said your friend, eh?
Roland nodded.
And she said something about the dark bells. I'd know more of that if wood were could.
She's something special, Jenna is. more like a princess, someone whose place is made by bloodline and can't be refused, than like the other sisters. I lie here and look like I'm asleep. It's safer, I think, but I've heard 'em talking. Jenna's just come back among 'em recently, and those dark bells mean something special. But Mary's still the one who swings the weight. I think the dark bells are only ceremonial, like the rings the old barons used to hand down from father to son. Was it she who put Jimmy's medal around your neck?
Yes.
Don't take it off, whatever you do.
His face was strained, grim.
I don't know if it's the gold or the god, but they don't like to get too close. I think that's the only reason I'm still here.
Now his voice dropped all the way to a whisper.
They ain't human.
Well, perhaps a bit fey and magical, but...
No!
With what was clearly an effort, the boy got up on one elbow. He looked at Roland earnestly.
You're thinking about hubber women or witches. These ain't hubbers nor witches either. They ain't human.
Then what are they?
Don't know.
How came you here, John?
Speaking in a low voice, John Norman told Roland what he knew of what had happened to him. He, his brother, and four other young men who were quick and owned good horses had been hired as scouts, riding drogue and forward, protecting a long-haul caravan of 7 freight wagons taking goods, seeds, food, tools, mail, and 4 ordered brides, to an unincorporated township called Tejas, some 200 miles farther west of Elluria. The scouts rode fore and aft of the goods train in turn and turnabout fashion. One brother rode with each party because, Norman explained, when they were together, they fought like, well...
Like brothers, Roland suggested.
John Norman managed a brief, pained smile.
Aye, he said.
The trio of which John was a part had been riding drogue about 2 miles behind the freight wagons when the green mutants had sprung an ambush in Elluria.
How many wagons did you see when you got there? He asked Roland.
Only one, overturned.
How many bodies?
Only your brothers.
John Norman nodded grimly.
They wouldn't take him because of the medallion, I think.
The muties?
The sisters. The muties care nothing for gold or God. These bitches, though.
He looked into the dark, which was now almost complete. Roland felt lethargy creeping over him again, but it wasn't until later that he realized the soup had been drugged.
The other wagons, Roland asked. The ones not overturned?
The muties would have taken them, and the goods as well, Norman said. They don't care for gold or God. The sisters don't care for goods. Like as not, they have their own foodstuffs, something I'd as soon not think of. Nasty stuff. Like those bugs.
He and the other drogue riders galloped into Elluria, but the fight was over by the time they got there. Men had been lying about, some dead, but many more still alive. At least 2 of the ordered brides had still been alive as well. Survivors able to walk were being herded together by the green folk. John Norman remembered the one in the bowler hat very well, and the woman in the ragged red vest. Norman and the other 2 had tried to fight. He had seen one of his pards gut shot by an arrow. And then he saw no more. Someone had cracked him over the head from behind, and the lights had gone out. Roland wondered if the ambusher had cried boo before he had struck, but didn't ask.
When I woke up again, I was here, Norman said. I saw that some of the others, most of them, had those cursed bugs on them.
Others?
Roland looked at the empty beds. In the growing darkness, they glimmered like white islands.
How many were brought here?
At least 20. They healed, the bugs healed them, and then, one by one, they disappeared. You'd go to sleep, and when you woke up, there'd be 1 more empty bed. One by one, they went, until only me and that one down yonder was left.
He looked at Roland solemnly.
And now you.
Norman.
Roland's head was swimming.
I reckon I know what's wrong with you, Norman said.
He seemed to speak from far away, perhaps from all the way around the curve of the earth. "It's the soup, but a man has to eat. A woman, too, if she's a natural woman, anyway. These ones ain't natural. Even Sister Jenna's not natural. Nice don't mean natural." Further and further away. "And she'll be like them in the end, mark me well." "Can't move." Saying even that required a huge effort. It was like moving boulders. "No," Norman suddenly laughed. It was a shocking sound and echoed in the growing blackness which filled Roland's head. "It ain't just sleep medicine they put in their soup. It's can't-move medicine, too." "There's nothing much wrong with me, brother. So why do you think I'm still here?" Norman was now speaking not from around the curve of the earth, but perhaps from the moon. He said, "I don't think either of us is ever going to see the sun shining on a flat piece of ground again."
"You're wrong about that," Roland tried to reply.
And more in that vein as well, but nothing came out. He sailed around to the black side of the moon, losing all his words in the void he found there. Yet he never quite lost awareness of himself. Perhaps the dose of medicine in Sister Coquina's soup had been badly calculated, or perhaps it was just that they never had a gunslinger to work their mischief on, and did not know they had one now. Except, of course, for Sister Jenna. She knew. At some point in the night, whispering, giggling voices and lightly chiming bells brought him back from the darkness where he had been biding, not quite asleep or unconscious. Around him, so constant he now barely heard it, were the singing doctors. Roland opened his eyes. He saw pale and chancy light dancing in the black air. The giggles and whispers were closer. Roland tried to turn his head and at first couldn't. He rested, gathered his will into a hard blue ball, and tried again. This time his head did turn. Only a little, but a little was enough. It was five of the little sisters. Mary, Louise, Tamara, Coquina, Michella. They came up the long aisle of the black infirmary, laughing together like children out on a prank, carrying long tapers and silver holders, the bells lining the forehead bands of their wimples, chiming little silver runs of sound. They gathered about the bed of the bearded man. From within their circle, candle glow rose in a shimmery column that died before it got halfway to the silken ceiling. Sister Mary spoke briefly. Roland recognized her voice, but not the words. It was neither low speech nor the high, but some other language entirely. One phrase stood out. "Candle latch, me him in tow." And he had no idea what it might mean. He realized that now he could hear only the tinkle of bells the doctor bugs had stilled.
"Ross, me, on, on," Sister Mary cried in a harsh, powerful voice.
The candles went out. The light that had shone through the wings of their wimples as they gathered around the bearded man's bed vanished, and all was darkness once more. Roland waited for what might happen next, his skin cold. He tried to flex his hands or feet and could not. He had been able to move his head perhaps 15 degrees, otherwise he was as paralyzed as a fly neatly wrapped up and hung in a spider's web. The low jingling of bells in the black, and then sucking sounds. As soon as he heard them, Roland knew he'd been waiting for them. Some part of him had known what the little sisters of Aluria were all along. If Roland could have raised his hands, he would have put them to his ears to block those sounds out. As it was, he could only lie still, listening and waiting for them to stop. For a long time, forever it seemed, they did not. The women slurped and grunted like pigs snuffling half-liquefied feed up out of a trough.
There was even one resounding belch, followed by more whispered giggles. These ended when Sister Mary uttered a single curt word,
"Heiss!"
And once there was a low moaning cry. From the bearded man, Roland was quite sure. If so, it was his last on this side of the clearing. In time, the sounds of their feeding began to taper off. As it did, the bugs began to sing again. First hesitantly, then with more confidence. The whispering and giggling recommenced. The candles were relit. Roland was by now lying with his head turned in the other direction. He didn't want them to know what he'd seen, but that wasn't all. He had no urge to see more on any account. He had seen and heard enough. But the giggles and whispers now came his way. Roland closed his eyes, concentrating on the medallion that lay against his chest. "I don't know if it's the gold or the god, but they don't like to get too close," John Norman had said. It was good to have such a thing to remember as the little sisters drew nigh, gossiping and whispering in their strange other tongue. But the medallion seemed a thin protection in the dark. Faintly, at a great distance, Roland heard the cross dog barking. As the sisters circled him, the gunslinger realized he could smell them. It was a low, unpleasant odor like spoiled meat. And what else would they smell of, such as these?
"Such a pretty man it is,"
Sister Mary. She spoke in a low, meditative tone.
"But such an ugly sickle it wears,"
Sister Tamra.
"We'll have it off him," Sister Louise.
"And then we shall have kisses,"
Sister Coquina.
"Kisses for all,"
exclaimed Sister Michella with such fervent enthusiasm that they all laughed. Roland discovered that not all of him was paralyzed after all. Part of him had, in fact, arisen from its sleep at the sound of their voices and now stood tall. A hand reached beneath the bed-dress he wore, touched that stiffened member, encircled it, caressed it. He lay in silent horror, feigning sleep, as wet warmth almost immediately spilled from him. The hand remained where it was for a moment, the thumb rubbing up and down the wilting shaft. Then it let him go and rose a little higher, found the wetness pooled on his lower belly. Giggles, soft as wind. Chiming bells. Roland opened his eyes the tiniest crack and looked up at the ancient faces laughing down at him in the light of their candles, glittering eyes, yellow cheeks, hanging teeth that jutted over lower lips. Sister Michella and Sister Louise appeared to have grown goatees, but of course that wasn't the darkness of hair, but of the bearded man's blood. Mary's hand was cupped. She passed it from sister to sister, each licked from her palm in the candlelight. Roland closed his eyes all the way and waited for them to be gone. Eventually, they were. "I'll never sleep again," he thought, and was 5 minutes later lost to himself and the world. 5. Sister Mary. A message. A visit from Ralph. Norman's fate. Sister Mary again. When Roland awoke, it was full daylight, the silk roof overhead a bright white and billowing in a mild breeze. The doctor bugs were singing contentedly. Beside him on his left, Norman was heavily asleep, with his head turned so far to one side that his stubbly cheek rested on his shoulder. Roland and John Norman were the only ones here. Farther down on their side of the infirmary, the bed where the bearded man had been was empty, its top sheet pulled up and neatly tucked in, the pillow neatly nestled in a crisp white case. The complication of slings in which his body had rested was gone. Roland remembered the candles, the way their glow had combined and streamed up in a column,
illuminating the sisters as they gathered around the bearded man, giggling, their damned bells jingling. Now, as if summoned by his thoughts, came Sister Mary, gliding along rapidly with Sister Louise in her wake. Louise bore a tray and looked nervous. Mary was frowning, obviously not in good temper.
"To be grumpy after you've fed so well," Roland thought. "Fie, sister."
She reached the gunslinger's bed and looked down at him.
"I have little to thank ye for, Si," she said with no preamble.
"Have I asked for your thanks?"
he responded in a voice that sounded as dusty and little used as the pages of an old book. She took no notice.
"Ye've made one who was only impudent and restless with her place, outright rebellious. Well, her mother was the same way, and died of it not long after returning Jenna to her proper place. Raise your hand, thankless man."
"I can't. I can't move at all."
"Oh, Callie, haven't you heard it said, fool not your mother lest she's out of face? I know pretty well what ye can and can't do. Now raise your hand."
Roland raised his right hand, trying to suggest more effort than it actually took. He thought that this morning he might be strong enough to slip free of the slings, but what then? Any real walking would be beyond him for hours yet, even without another dose of medicine. And behind Sister Mary, Sister Louise was taking the cover from a fresh bowl of soup. As Roland looked at it, his stomach rumbled. Big Sister heard and smiled a bit.
"Even lying in bed builds an appetite in a strong man if it's done long enough. Wouldn't you say so, Jason, brother of John?"
"My name is James, as you well know, sister."
"Do I?"
She laughed angrily.
"Oh, la! And if I whipped your little sweetheart hard enough and long enough, until the blood jumped out of her back like drops of sweat, let us say, should I not whip a different name out of her? Or didn't ye trust her with it during your little talk?"
"Touch her and I'll kill you."
She laughed again. Her face shimmered. Her firm mouth turned into something that looked like a dying jellyfish.
"Speak not of killing to us, Cully, lest we speak of it to you."
"Sister, if you and Jenna don't see eye to eye, why not release her from her vows and let her go her course?"
"Such as us can never be released from our vows, nor be let go. Her mother tried and then came back, her dying and the girl sick. Why, it was we nursed Jenna back to health after her mother was nothing but dirt in the breeze that blows out toward Endworld, and how little she thanks us. Besides, she bears the dark bells, the sigil of our sisterhood, of our quartet. Now eat. Your belly says ye're hungry."
Sister Louise offered the bowl, but her eyes kept drifting to the shape the medallion made under the breast of his bed-dress.
"Don't like it, do you?"
Roland thought, and then remembered Louise by candlelight, the freighter's blood on her chin, her ancient eyes eager as she leaned forward to lick his spend from Sister Mary's hand. He turned his head aside.
"I want nothing."
"But you're hungry," Louise protested. "If ye don't eat, James, how will ye get his strength back?"
"Send Jenna. I'll eat what she brings."
Sister Mary's frown was black.
"Ye'll see her no more. She's been released from Thoughtful House only on her solemn promise to double her time of meditation and to stay out of infirmary. Now eat, James, or whoever ye are. Take what's in the soup, or we'll cut ye with knives and rub it in with flannel poultices. Either way, makes no difference to us, does it, Louise?"
"Nah,"
Louise said. She still held out the bowl. Steam rose from it and the good smell of chicken.
"But it might make a difference to you."
Sister Mary grinned humorlessly, baring her unnaturally large teeth.
"Flowing blood's risky around here."